I've been battered, but I never bruised. It's not so bad. Just an ordinary day, and it's all your state of mind. That's Great Big C. I'm Blake Murphy. This is a Canada Day version of Jay's Talk Plus. Yes, we're with you for Canada Day. If you are hearing us, that means you are listening on the Sportsnet Radio Network outside of Toronto or on the AltStream online, or you're with us on Sportsnet 360 or Sportsnet Plus. If you are looking for NHL free agency and NBA free agency coverage, JD Bunkus has you covered over on the Fan 590 in Toronto for that. It is, of course, the open of NHL free agency. It is the open of NBA free agency. And yeah, numbers like Isaiah Hartenstein getting 3 years, $87 million from the Oklahoma City Thunder are out there. The Thunder are serious. The Toronto Blue Jays, a little less serious over the weekend. They end up splitting a series with the Yankees that included a 16-5 loss on Friday, a 9-3 win on Saturday, and then an 8-1 loss on Sunday. No shortage of offense, especially when it comes to Vladimir Guerrero Jr., who set a franchise record with 6 consecutive multi-RBI games. He has 20 runs knocked in over his last 9 games and an OPS pushing close to 950 since the calendar turned to May 2 months ago now. So nice stuff from Vlad. Not great stuff from the Blue Jays overall, though. 2-2 against the Yankees team that came in sputtering. The Jays, of course, stay well below 500, well out of the American League wildcard race. 2-2 against the Yankees, who are so far above 500, may have felt like something that was a positive a few weeks back, especially early in the season. In the situation the Blue Jays are in, you can't split any series right now. You're 7.5 back of that final wildcard with a bunch of teams to chase, including the Houston Astros, who have won 9 of 10 and are in town for 4 starting today down at Rogers Center at 3 o'clock. It's Yariel Rodriguez against Hunter Brown. We'll get you set up for that one. Throughout the show, we'll talk to Robert Orr of Baseball Prospectus, who wrote about Hunter Brown very recently. Talk to our pal Bobby Wagner down in New York about another surging team that's very, very funny, the New York Mets. We will also go through some history of the Blue Jays on Canada Day. I went back through a lot of game logs. It's been a long time. The Jays obviously annually playing at home on this day, and a mixed bag. Hopefully today's game is not 19 innings because that might be too much for me, and it might be too much for our first guest, Caitlin McGrath of The Athletic, who joins us now. Caitlin, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I am good. Fingers crossed for as great as that game was back in 2016. No 19-inning game today, right?
Yeah, no. Prefer just the standard 9.
I think that game may have been a big part of the reason we now have ghost runners. everyone driving. I believe that was the holiday. I can't remember, but I was driving back from a friend's cottage, and in the 7th inning of that game, we were like, oh, we'll just turn the game on. And then it lasted us the whole drive home, and it was still on when we got back. We don't need to do that today. Caitlin, Jays split a series against the Yankees. I know that one ended tough yesterday. What was the general, I know John Schneider called it a weird series, and it kind of was. What was the vibe after the game yesterday coming out of there with just 2 against a Yankees team that had been sputtering so much?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you said it well in that, a couple months ago, splitting a series against the Yankees, who are obviously leading the American League East, would have been seen as a positive, or at least a partial positive. But, at this point, John Schneider said it, every game you lose is basically a missed opportunity. And, it was a strange series because they were all blowouts on either side, which is kind of unexpected, especially with the offense from the Blue Jays. It's finally coming around, which is a good thing. But obviously the bullpen is really reeling at this point. I mean, just injuries and underperformance, and even the guys that remain in the bullpen have been inconsistent at best. So, I think the feeling around the Jays team was not really of satisfaction of splitting the series against the Yankees. I think it was just kind of sort of further realization that they really don't have room for error in these types of games, or these types of series, I should say. And I think what also kind of contributed to the downer kind of attitude after the game was just Gosman's kind of struggled this year. Mm-hmm. And, it's been kind of a strange season for him. I think I heard, on your show, I think a couple weeks ago, just talking about, Gosman's struggles and sort of questioning the effectiveness of the splitter and the fastball combination that has been good, so good to him for, you know, many years, that has made him one of the best starters in the American League, or in all of baseball when he was in the National League. So, you know, he talked a little bit about, you know, splitters not carrying the zone as much. You know, the fastball isn't as effective. They can kind of sit on the fastball, I think, when they can kind of just take the splitter, I should say. And Gosman, you know, has a couple other pitches he uses, but not ones that are as effective or as consistent. So it's been kind of a weird season for him. And so I think that, you know, talking to him afterwards was just kind of one of those moments where you sort of realize the Blue Jays are not in a good spot right now.
Yeah, and it's not as if Kevin Gausman has been awful, but going from a guy who's on Cy Young ballots to an average-ish starting pitcher who you worry about a little bit against better teams, I mean, this Blue Jays team is built on their rotation, and the only way they're going to, or the only way they've been able to win games the last year and a half, at least until the last week or so, has been on the strength of that starting pitching. So Gausman going from, you know, an ace to someone who looks more like a number four starter is a big dip. What was Kevin Gausman saying after the game? Because he's someone who has sounded frustrated with his own performance at times this year, and certainly, you know, I don't want to project too much, but looked it on the mound yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, I think he was just kind of channeling that frustration that he was feeling. I mean, he's always a true professional around us, and he's always giving us sort of very thoughtful, careful answers. So it was more of that, but you could just kind of get the sense that he is frustrated that he's just not been able to be the guy that he typically has been for these last few years. And like I said before, there was a lot of talk about, you know, there was questions about how does he feel about, you know, where the fastball and his splitter are right now. And I think he said something along the lines of, like, not great. I don't feel great about those pitches because, again, like, the splitter, the way he talked about it, it was not carrying the zone as much. And I think when it's like that, guys can just, you know, sit on it. That they know they're not going to swing at it. I think he was also talking a little bit about having to throw the splitter even harder than he's thrown it, and that could help the pitch. I think there's part of the frustration was also that some of the underlying metrics of his pitches still look really good, but he's just, like, not getting the results on it as well. And, you know, he talked a little bit, although he was unclear about just the idea of the game changing. I haven't noticed if he's had any issues with the pitch clock or sort of the variations that we have in the game now, pitch calm, all this kind of stuff. But, you know, he spoke a little bit about how the game has changed over the last few years. And I don't know, maybe it's a little bit more of a cat and mouse challenge with other teams. And a team like the Yankees is always looking for an edge. So whether it's them playing around with the clock or various guys doing different things in the batter's box, you know, I'm not totally sure, but maybe that was just a product of him also sort of just sounding off on frustration and kind of just talking about how the game's different and how pitchers have to think about a lot more on the mound than they did a few years ago. And so I suspect that maybe he was just sort of channeling some frustration. I don't know if there was, like, a broader point with that. If there was, he didn't really want to get into it with us, understandably so. But yeah, I just read into it that he's just not feeling his best. And I'm sure that, as you said, like, he kind of knows his team is built on starting pitching and kind of built around him being the kind of leader of the rotation. And if he's not doing his end of the bargain, then, you know, the team does suffer.
It's an interesting point about the game changing, because, you know, that's something I maybe would have expected to hear from him if he had gotten run on a bunch in that game, for example, because he's not someone who controls the running game super well. You know, maybe that's something that would have frustrated him. But, like, you know, not being able to shift anymore. Well, Kevin Gausman didn't like the shift that much 2 years ago, and the Jays, like, ratcheted back the shift when he was getting batting average on balls in play was just through the roof. So I don't know. That's an interesting one that you know, I'll try to, I'm sure you will as well, try to dig in on that a little bit more with him in the future. Caitlin, a few other notes on the pitching side over the weekend. You wrote a really great piece about an unfortunate story on Saturday. Tim Mayza was designated for assignment. So if anyone missed it over the weekend, Mayza was designated for assignment. He's 7 days now to trade him or put him through waivers. Jose Kwas came up in his place. Tim Mayza had been the longest tenured Blue Jay on the roster by service time. Some of that was spent on the IL, but you know, he was the longest tenured guy by who had got there first. He was the longest tenured person in the organization back in 2013. He was drafted in the 12th round. Danny Jansen was drafted in the 16th round. So Tim Mazza beat him into the organization by like an hour on draft day. This was a tough one. We could tell from, I was down there with you on Saturday, and we could tell from talking to John Schneider, we could tell from talking to a couple of the other guys that this was a tough one on the room. What can you tell us? And again, you wrote a great piece about it for The Athletic. But for our audience, what can you tell us about what went into that Tim Mazza decision and how the room felt about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that people who have been watching the Blue Jays and watching the bullpen perform probably would have maybe sensed that something could be coming with Mazza. He just obviously wasn't performing to the standard that he had established in previous years. I mean, last year you talked about his results. He was one of the best relievers in all of baseball. He had a sub-2 ERA. I think that was top five among all qualified relievers. You know, he was striking guys out. He was generating a lot of weak contact. That was kind of his game. Obviously, as a left-handed pitcher, he has, you know, an advantage over lefties, and so he was used strategically that way. But, you know, he was just really effective all the way around. And, you know, this year, it seemed like from the get-go, you know, he just didn't have the same stuff. The velocity wasn't as consistent. It was down. Just down overall and just not as consistent as it needed to be. And, you know, because he's only a two-pitch pitcher and he was having, I think his slider wasn't having the same effect as it had in previous years. And so, you know, the velo is down, the stuff is down. And then, you know, being a guy that relies on contact, if you're not getting the soft contact and all the contact is hard contact, which you know, seemed to be something that was happening to him a lot. He was giving up a lot of home runs, just giving up a lot of contact. And I think it just got to the point where the Blue Jays tried different things with him, tried tweaking his pitch mix, tried tweaking his delivery, just tried different things with him, and it really wasn't working. And yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate. Someone even asked, like, well, why not IL him? And it's like, well, he's not hurt. You know, Blue Jays aren't going to do that. So it was definitely a tough decision. I think that, you know, Tim Mazza, one of the, like, nicest, most professional guys you'll come across in baseball. I mean, I got to know him, you know, decently well as a reporter can get to know a player probably. Had a lot of great conversations with him, knew how much the fellow bullpen guys, you know, loved him. He was the guy that always was on the field first when it came to the relievers going out and throwing. He was always on time. He was a real stickler for being on time and kind of kept all the relievers in line, but did so in a way that was, you know, kind of serious but also joking. So he was the type of guy that definitely could take a joke, was kind of beloved on the team for being a guy that they could tease, but very playfully. And so I think that hit the team hard. And it's just, it's not only, you know, realizing that, you know, he's no longer on the team, but it's just also kind of seeing him struggle. I think everybody knows he's a better pitcher than he showed this year. And I think that along with people being, you know, sad that he's gone, I think there's also a lot of kind of hope that he can catch on with another team and have like a, you know, a good second act.
Yes. And even if it's not, you know, this year, and who knows, there are enough teams with bullpen needs that someone will probably take a flyer on him once he's cheap and has cleared waivers or whatever. But certainly, you know, you look ahead to next year or something like that, he wouldn't be the first reliever to have a rough season, get an extended off season and bounce right back. A huge hole in the team's fantasy football league. Well, as we learned from him having to be bat boy earlier in the season. He also, by the way, closes out his Jays tenure, if this is it, because there's still a scenario where he clears waivers and accepts an outright to the minors. It seems unlikely, but you know, I won't close the book entirely yet. But eighth all time in appearances for pitchers as a Toronto Blue Jay for Tim Mazza. Caitlin, you mentioned this in your story. It's not just Tim Mazza now. It is also Eric Swanson, who is down in AAA trying to work through things. Jimmy Garcia is on the IL. Jordan Romano is going to see the Keith Meister, Dr. Keith Meister, for another opinion on his elbow tomorrow after being shut down again. The top four pitchers in terms of appearances and leverage from last season are all not available to this Blue Jays team right now. Obviously, everyone always says you can never have enough bullpen depth, etc. But where does this bullpen go from here? Your top four guys down year over year, I don't really know. Like, we're almost at the point where, like, you can't you can nitpick, I guess, but like any of John Schneider's bullpen decisions are just like, well, who's in there? Like there's nobody. Where does the bullpen go from here, Caitlin?
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you were to tell somebody at the start of the year that the Blue Jays aren't going to have Romano, Swanson, Meza, and Garcia available out of the bullpen, you would know that something has gone horribly wrong with the bullpen, which it has. Like, it's very difficult for a team to be able to sustain, you know, an elite or a good bullpen when, you know, the bullpen they kind of built around, the relievers they built around, are no longer on the team or just completely ineffective. And so, I mean, John Schneider is obviously in a tough spot. And, you know, the other element of that is that the Blue Jays haven't really had any other relievers kind of step up and come out of nowhere. And sometimes you need a story like that. You need a couple stories like that. And so the only possibility for the Blue Jays to have withstood this kind of hit on their bullpen would have been, you know, if Pop and Pearson and maybe someone else from the minor leagues was able to come up and just dominate and sort of like take the mantle from guys like Swanson and Meza, who were obviously dominant last year. And they just haven't had that. You've seen flashes of guys. I think Schneider said something along the lines of, you know, there's been guys that have stepped up in certain moments, but they haven't done so enough consistently as a group that, you know, you're able to withstand the loss that you've had to your bullpen. And that's when those 16-5 games happen, is just because, you know, the bullpen is not able to keep a game right there. You know, things get out of hand in a hurry. And it's been tough. Like, I think that if so much attention has been on the offense, understandably so, with this team, because it has also very underperformed. But I think that part of that underperformance kind of overshadowed the bullpen performance. And I think now that the offense is going a little bit, you know, Vlad said he's Springer's finally hitting, Justin Turner's looking better. You know, a lot of guys are looking a lot better. And now we're kind of, the bullpen is getting exposed a little bit. And so it is kind of on brand for this Blue Jays team in this season to, you know, have the offense finally get going and then have the bullpen fall apart. I mean, that's been an issue with this team in previous years where they're not having their sort of elements of the team clicking all at once. And that, to me, that seems to be probably going to be another issue with the team this year, is that, and part of that is just like, you know, there's not enough arms, right? There's not enough guys that can come in and click, because you just don't have the caliber right now to have an elite bullpen.
Okay, Caitlin, I know we got to let you go because you've got to get down to the park, but very briefly here, there are 24 games for the Blue Jays before the trade deadline. You wrote about, you know, what direction the Jays could go, what they're waiting for here coming out of Ross Atkins' media availability last week. Is there anything that could happen over these next 24 games that is a realistic scenario where the Blue Jays are not sellers?
I don't think so. I mean, the only thing that could happen would be a 10-game winning streak or something like that, in which case maybe they narrow their deficit in the wild card race to, you know, 3 games or something. But the likelihood of that happening, just because of all the things that we just previously talked about, the fact that, you know, their bullpen is struggling, their offense is still inconsistent, they've got starting pitching that is kind of bubbling up with question marks. You know, we're not sure about Rodriguez and Gausman. So I think the likelihood of them going on a run is low. And if that is low, then I just don't think they're going to be able to make up the deficit that they've dug for themselves. Truthfully, I haven't looked ahead at the schedule, but even playing Houston these 4 games, Houston's coming in really hot. And then I guess I go on the West Coast, which is always a very tough trip to do. Seattle, San Francisco, and Arizona, even though all those teams aren't necessarily like winning teams, other than Seattle that is leading the AL, or yeah, the AL West. You know, it's tough to go to the West Coast and, you know, have a winning streak. So I just don't think things are on the Blue Jays side right now. I think that they've kind of run out of time. I know there's still half a season left, but they've more or less run out of time. And I think, you know, maybe the likelihood of that they are sellers, I don't know what degree of sellers they'll be. My sense is that probably just going to get rid of the guys that are on 1-year deals. I don't know that they're going to punt on next year at this point, but I think that we're going to see some sort of sell-off. I think that's just the most pragmatic move going forward with this team.
Yeah, they're not going 24-0 over the next 24, I don't think. Caitlin McGrath, thank you so much for taking the time out this morning. I'll see you down at the ballpark in a little bit.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Caitlin McGrath of The Athletic. Make sure you're checking out all her great work over there, as well as her colleagues. Ken Rosenthal continues to kind of let us know that the Sharks are circling if the Jays are going to sell off more than just the expirings. Jim Bowden, who's going to join us a little later in the week, writing, you know, hey, Yusei Kikuchi's up there among the starting pitching ranks of who could be available. Jimmy Garcia up there among the relief pitcher ranks of who could be available. You know, a Trevor Richards would have value. Obviously, some of the vet guys like Kiermaier and Turner, there could be a sell-off here. And the Jays, you know, as much as two of those wins in that series were fun, and it's great that George Springer's hitting, and it's great that Vlad is on a heater here, none of that really changes that the Jays are 7.5 back of the wild card with a whole bunch of teams they'd have to jump. Even if you came out of this series having swept the Astros, say, you know, you're still going to be at least 3.5 games back, and you would have pulled even with the Astros, not even jumped them, and the Astros aren't particularly close to the wild card either. So there is just too much work to be done, and there's, you could convince yourself, I guess, if you were super, super optimistic, that you could make up that 7.5 by the end of September, but that's not when you have to make up enough ground by. You have to make it up by the end of July, enough to convince this front office to not sell, which I just, Caitlin said it, it's not pragmatic. It's not particularly likely, unless this team has a big, big run right now in them that I don't think many of us think they have. Again, Vlad Heater aside, because it has been a very, very fun franchise record. It ended yesterday, but 6 consecutive games with multiple RBI in a row. He also, over the last 9 games, has 6 homers, 20 runs batted in, and a 1.476 OPS. Now a 942 OPS since May 1st. And if we look at his season-long numbers relative to league average, he is now up to a 143 OPS plus, which, again, controls for the league factors and things like that because offense is down. That is the second-best season of his career. Still, you know, not the quick power heater here still hasn't, you know, all the way caught up. He's still on pace for, you know, 25, 26 home runs, which most people would agree probably isn't enough, but he's also hitting 297, which is pretty darn good. One other guy who could potentially be on the move as an expiring contract, and we mentioned him off the Tim Mesa there, is Danny Jansen. Couple injury updates for you, although I guess in Danny Jansen's case, not an injury update, but he was placed on the paternity list today. We saw Brian Servin in the clubhouse on Saturday. We knew that Danny Jansen's wife would be was expecting in the coming days. So Danny Jansen will be away from the team for a couple days. Brian Servin is up to be the backup catcher in his place. I mentioned a little earlier, Jordan Romano is going to see the Keith Meister, Dr. Keith Meister, on Tuesday. He was shut down again after once again experiencing elbow soreness while playing catch. So we're talking about 3-4 instances now, if you go back to spring training, of Romano having elbow soreness. They've said that the imaging they've gotten back has shown no structural damage, but anytime this lingers on like this, you've got to be pretty concerned. Tim Mesa, as we discussed with Caitlin, was designated for assignment, and Jose Kwas was called up in his place. Jose Kwas has a really cool backstory, by the way. Hopefully he's around long enough for us to tell it properly. Probably makes more of an article than a radio segment. But he, in addition to, so he got drafted way back in the day as a like power hitting position player. That didn't work out. He transitioned to pitching, and shortly, like around the pandemic, he was a FedEx delivery driver who was just like throwing with his brother on the side to try to make his way back in baseball. So quite the path back to the major leagues for Jose Kwas. Got to meet him on Saturday. Very nice guy. Hopefully he's someone who can help this bullpen a little bit. We'll see, because the bullpen's in disarray right now. So much so that the Jays even made a trade on the weekend. They traded for Yeri Rodriguez, who is just, you know, AAA relief pitching depth. Not great numbers in the major leagues, not great numbers at AAA, although he does have a lot of swing and miss stuff. The issue is that he also walks a ton of guys. So your typical kind of quad A reliever, your stuff is good enough to miss bats probably at a major league level, but the command isn't there. And because, you know, because you can't locate him, because guys swing and miss so much, they're going to sit back and take a lot of walks. So we'll see if Yeri Rodriguez can figure some stuff out of Buffalo. The Jays, by the way, traded Josh Malaris in that deal. He was their 10th round pick. Last year, he was pitching out of the bullpen at High A Vancouver. So I mentioned, by the way, Tim Mesa got designated for assignment. He is 8th all-time in appearances among pitchers for the Toronto Blue Jays. We're going to do a bunch of Jays history stuff today because it's a holiday and we're not on main radio. And I don't know, it's a 3 p.m. game, so it's hard to get Blue Jays and Astros people on here. So we're going to do some other stuff a little later. But the seven players ahead of Tim Mazza, the Blue Jays all-time franchise leader for pitcher games played. Obviously, position players, there are a bunch of guys who have played more. Immediately ahead of him is Aaron Loop. I thought Tim Mazza might get the catch Aaron Loop. He was 17 appearances away. Aaron Loop lasted on the team from 2012 to 2018. Tim Mazza from 2017 to 2024. So that tells you that there is going to be one of these lefties that's in the bullpen right now will now last this year for like 6 years, because that has been, someone's going to take the Aaron Loop, Tim Mazza. I believe it was Jesse Carlson before that. There's always one kind of lefty reliever who feels like a core part of the team. That's the way it goes. Ahead of Loop and Mazza, Paul Quantrill, Casey Jansen, Dave Steeb, who, a lot of those were starts, which makes it even more impressive. 408 starts and 31 relief appearances for the Blue Jays, and 103 complete games. Dave Steeb has more complete games than most hit pitchers in Blue Jays history have games, period. Tom Hanke and Dwayne Ward, of course, 2 and 3 on that list. And number one, by a good margin, Jason Frazier, from 2004 to 2012, over a couple stints with the team, appeared in 505 games. So if it feels like Tim Mazza has been with this team for a very long time, and he has, if it feels like Tim Mazza has been in this organization for a very long time, and he has, he came up 153 games short of Jason Frazier. That's how long Jason Frazier stuck around, how many times he came back. And yeah, Jason Frazier wrapped his Jays career with a 3.73 ERA. Tim Mazza with a 3.87. Tim Mazza over the last 3 years, probably some of the best relief work you can find, really, from a lefty arm, especially in the non-Loogie era. He had a 1.52 ERA last season and then 8.03 this year. It sucks the way that relief pitching goes sometimes, and you know, it doesn't happen to all relievers, but we've seen very much this year how it can happen for some relievers. So we wish Tim Mazza the best wherever he lands next. And again, there's still like a small window for that to be with Toronto. I don't imagine he would accept an outright assignment if he clears waivers. He has enough service time where he could say, no, thank you, I'm going to elect free agency. So we'll see how that plays out in the coming days. I don't know how many of you who are listening will text the text line, because again, we're not on terrestrial radio in Toronto today. But if you are, you could text us to 590-590. Around 11:30, we're going to open up the mailbag. We're going to do some Jays history stuff, look at some of their previous games on Canada Day in the past. I have, of course, in my Canada basketball jacket here from Casey Bannerman, which is just all kinds of sharp heading into the Olympics here. We'll have Dan Schulman on later in the week. I'd imagine some Canada basketball stuff will come up, because that Olympic team is in training camp right now on the men's side. And then tomorrow, actually, during the show, we're not going to carry it on this show because this is a Jay show and we'll be breaking down that Astros game. But the women's Olympic roster, or at least the kind of extended camp roster, will be released tomorrow as well. So very exciting time for Canada on the basketball side and all around Canadian sport a couple weeks out from the Olympics here. Probably room to talk about that stuff more as the Jays continue to fall down the standings, or at least not make up any ground. Let's take a break. On the other side, let's talk about a team that has made up some ground in the standings and maybe the Jays can learn something from. We're going to talk a little bit of Mets. We're going to whip around Major League Baseball with Bobby Wagner of Tipping Pitches. That's next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Diving deep into Leafs, Raptors, Jays, and NFL. The JD Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays split a series this weekend with the Yankees. They'll now face the Astros 4-4. The Astros are quite hot. They've won 9 of their last 10. And on the weekend, we had the two hottest teams in baseball going head-to-head. The Houston Astros managed to take 2 of 3 off of the New York Mets, who have won 16 of their last 22 to get back in the National League wildcard race. The Astros and Mets kind of doing their own things in each respective wildcard race. The thing the Blue Jays were supposed to have done over the last month, they haven't been able to pull it off. Let's check in on those Mets, who are not only on fire, but are one of the most fun teams in all of baseball. Let's do it with our pal Bobby Wagner of Tipping Pitches. Bobby, what's up, man? Thank you for doing this. How we doing?
I'm good, man. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here to talk about a good thing happening in the world of New York Mets fans. It's rare, Blake, but it's fun nonetheless.
It is. It's got to be so bizarre. Are you a Knicks fan too?
I'm not. I did not grow up as a basketball fan. I did not pick up basketball in the NBA until I started playing as more of a teenager. So I did not like intentionally sign up for that New York Knicks fandom on top of the New York Mets fandom. I was like, I think I got enough of a dose of this with the New York Mets.
That's very fair. I was just going to say, just for those New York fans who are Mets and Knicks, it's got to be bizarre to have the Knicks being like a well-functioning, well-run team now, and the Mets having a little bit of success here. So let's talk about those Mets. 16-6 over the last 22. They're back right on the doorstep of the wild card. And I mean, I guess just from a fan perspective, what has it been like for like this? Like you joke there about this Mets team actually having good things to talk about, and a team being bad and bad in like a funny, deranged way for years and years does something to a fan base. How are you guys finding cheering for a good Mets team lately?
I think we're just trying to soak it up as much as possible. I was talking with my co-host Alex about, he was basically giving me a tough time about how Mets fans need to pick one of the sort of talisman things that is going on right now to latch onto, whether that's Grimace, whether that's OMG by Jose Iglesias, whether that's playing extremely well in June as we celebrate Pride Month here in New York and the rest of America. I told him, go kick rocks. We can have all of our fun things, and we have enough of an appetite for all of those things because they're so rare when they come along in the baseball world. And you know as well as anybody, it's a very superstitious bunch, baseball fans. So I told him we don't need to choose just one of those things. So that's a long way of saying, I mean, it's been incredibly fun, and it feels like it can never just be normal. And this probably feels the same for a lot of fan bases. It feels like it can never just be normal for a baseball team. Like you have to have the incredibly high highs and the incredibly depressing and intense lows in order to come out on the other side of this incredibly long season and feel like it was worth something in the end.
Yeah, it does seem that way. It's a weird one because like if you go back to like 2020, 2021, the vibes and things like that were pretty good around the Blue Jays. Like 2021, they introduced the home run jacket and they were the first team to kind of do something like that. They had the Barrio, mm-hmm. which was like a handful of the players at the end of the dugout, always goofing around, throwing seeds, stuff like that. And then they've kind of lost that, and expectations have continued to climb. The team hasn't gotten any better, and all the fun parts have been taken away. Right. So that's been tough. There's been no Grimace. There's been no, I know you said Jose Iglesias. It's Candelita. That's let's be clear about his recording name.
Put some respect on that man's name.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Absolutely. And Pete Alonso's joining in on it now too, I saw.
Yeah, yeah. He's like, the whole team seems to have genuinely turned their mood around, which is a rare thing for an MLB clubhouse. You know, I think that in a way, in this really intense blend of personalities and people that is an MLB clubhouse with that many, you know, strong egos, strong opinions in there, it's rare for it to change halfway through. But for whatever reason, you know, you want to call it, whether that's a song from a journeyman middle infielder who came on board just because the Mets were a little bit short on depth, or whether it's just the silliness of a McDonald's mascot throwing out a first pitch. I think that you just have to latch on to whatever works.
Yeah, and
for your
team.
And
sorry, I should have explained this to the audience. For anyone who hasn't seen it, like the Grimace thing is Grimace botched the first pitch and then the Mets went on a heater. But Jose Iglesias, who everyone is familiar with from Boston and Detroit and Colorado and Baltimore, and I'm sure he's played on some other teams that I'm forgetting as well, gets called up and everyone's wearing OMG shirts. He has a track called OMG under the name Candelita, and like the players are singing it and things like that. I should have explained that before I set it up. But Bobby, like Jose Iglesias, like his roster spot is safe now, right?
It has to be. I mean, the team would revolt if they cut him now. I'm actually genuinely really worried about that because the Mets are now, I'm sure a lot of baseball fans around the league know, the Mets replaced their front office. Now they're being run by David Stearns, who used to run the Milwaukee Brewers. This is a very cold, calculating, clinical man. That's what made him successful with the Milwaukee organization. And so I'm a little bit worried that if they need that roster spot for something more important, like a reliever at the trade deadline, because the bullpen is not looking so hot right now, as is the case with a lot of teams. These guys drop like flies. I'm a little bit worried that David Stearns is the type of guy who would make that decision, honestly. But I think that his spot is safe enough. And honestly, Jose Iglesias is playing really well. So it's not just the streams on Spotify. Like, it's the hits to the gap.
Yeah, I mean, he's hitting over 400 since he got the call-up. So, you know, color me a little skeptical to maintain, but the vibes can maintain. OMG is obviously the song of the summer in New York. And that's important because there was a way that a different song of the summer could have represented this New York Mets team, Bright Eyes. So Connor Oberst, so for anyone who doesn't know, Bright Eyes, like an emo act who just dropped a new song that specifically says, like, do not bet on the New York Mets. And it's like a weird aside in the song, but how did that feel? I know you're a music guy too. Bright Eyes taking just a stray shot at the Mets here.
You know, on one hand, it could be perceived as a stray. And frankly, I think that it was meant as a stray. But on the other hand, you know, maybe Connor Oberst is just trying to say, be careful with the ways that you bet. And on baseball, it's tough. I think that baseball is a sport that is very challenging to bet on. So maybe Connor Oberst was just trying to give advice to people. I don't really know. I think that I consider this a win. Anytime that the Mets are relevant enough in culture to stretch to the far reaches of emo lyrics, I personally, as a Mets fan and as a huge music fan, consider that a win, because more often it would be the lower hanging fruit, like the New York Yankees or something like that. So I think that's a win for us.
Do you have and maybe this is it, but do you have a favorite, like, hey, artist shouts a team specifically, whether it's your team or not? Like, I'm not a Winnipeg Jets fan, but I love In One Great City when John K. Sampson of the Weaker Thans just drops in the Jets were lousy anyway. You know, just a little elbow at the hometown team. Do you have a favorite one of those?
I think for me, it's Piazza New York Catcher, the Bell and Sebastian song, which is legendary amongst such disparate groups of people that I consider myself a part of, like the deep cut music fans, as well as like Mets fandom. It's not like a widely held love in Mets fandom, Piazza New York Catcher, but it's so specifically rendered, talking about his batting average and talking about a series against the Giants. It's the song Piazza New York Catcher.
It's a pretty good choice there. All the Blue Jays ones are like gimmicky, like they were designed specifically for that. And that's not quite the same thing. You know, it's not quite the same. Okay. More on the actual baseball side. You mentioned the bullpen of the New York Mets is in disarray because 28 bullpens around baseball are like everyone other than Cleveland and Milwaukee. It just has an awful bullpen. Yes. Right now, the Mets situation made worse by Edwin Diaz getting suspended, not for an illegal substance, but for too much of a legal substance. What did you make of that, and where we kind of draw the lines with that kind of thing? And I realize I'm going from a very jokey start of this conversation to now a serious, like, how do we, you know, how do we police the game kind of question here on you?
I think that the sticky stuff rules are pretty well intentioned, and I think that largely have been enforced, you know, fairly, and it doesn't seem like it's affected too many teams. I think that there are a couple kinks to iron out with it. Namely, I think that players feel a lot of confusion about what is quote unquote too much of the legal substance. And, you know, for listeners at home, like, there are legal substances that you're allowed to use to help get grip on the balls, to help you control the ball so that it's not dangerous for the hitters, with pitchers throwing harder than they ever have thrown. And one of those substances is the rosin bag that is very obviously present on the mound. It's very obvious that that is legal to use. However, if you use too much of that rosin and you combine it with something like sweat or water or whatever, it can become extremely sticky. And umpires have been instructed to know the difference between when it's too much and when it's an acceptable amount. I think that just, it seems like the players don't really know what the umpires have been told or taught. Umpires attend classes in the off season, and it's a very funny image to think about, Blake, honestly, but they go around and they touch different surfaces to feel how sticky they are and to feel whether or not something is above a certain barometer of stickiness and whether or not they should throw a player out if their hand feels like that during the check during the game. I think that is the first thing. Players need a little bit more transparency about what is too much of the legal substance. We know that we shouldn't be using spider tack anymore. That is obvious. That was the flashpoint. However, I think the rosin thing, and it seems like it's been an issue with the Mets because this happened to Max Scherzer way back when, last year when he was still on the New York Mets. He was ejected from a game against the Dodgers where he was at least provided the opportunity first to wash his hand. And then when he came back out, It was a whole, it was like a chemistry lesson about how if you wash your hand with hand sanitizer, it actually makes it stickier. And then he was ejected. And the second thing that leads me to the second thing, which is that it's a 10-game suspension and you don't get to replace that person's roster spot. That's a pretty steep penalty. It becomes even steeper when that person is a reliever, because it's one thing if you lose a starter for 10 games, that's two turns through the rotation and you can call someone up from AAA. But if you can't replace a reliever spot, that's really challenging, because that could be 4, 5, 6 appearances if it's your highest leverage reliever, like it is for the Mets with Edwin Diaz. So I honestly think that there should be a different suspension rule for relievers than for starters.
Yeah,
and I think that those are kind of some common sense changes that the league should look into, so that you don't get a situation where a guy comes in cold like Drew Smith. And now his elbow was already singing before this, but he comes in cold to a game because Edwin Diaz was supposed to be pitching. And he leaves 2 days later with an elbow injury because he had to warm up on the spot, not being ready to be used in that game.
Yeah, that's a great point about differing the rules a little bit for relievers and starters. And yeah, I mean, if we go just on precedent, while pitcher suspensions are heavily indexed to starters who we obviously suspend for 5 or 6 games to make sure they miss a start. So that's a good point there. On the more positive side, and I guess this is like a positive couched in a little bit of a concern, but the Mets being as good as they are and getting back into the wild card picture here, this was a team that it kind of sounded like at last year's deadline, the focus would shift toward like 2025 and moving forward, but they're pretty good right now. And they have a couple guys who would probably have generated some pretty good interest at the trade deadline, like a Pete Alonso who's on he's a free agent at the end of the season. Do you think they've done enough to kind of shift this? And again, you mentioned the new front office is pretty cold and calculating. They might not care about a fun 16-6 stretch. Have they done enough to maybe shift that deadline strategy to, a modest buy or at least a hold?
I think they have so far, with the caveat being it's still July. It's still the beginning of July. So it's early. They have a lot of time to fall further back in the standings. The NL wildcard race right now is incredibly cluttered. A lot of teams within a few games. Many of those teams are 1 or 2 games over 500 or 1 or 2 games under 500. So I think there's still a lot of clarity to be gained through the month of July. But I think the Mets have, because I think if you listen to David Stern's press conferences, of which there are many, this man has made himself available to New York media, which New York media loves to talk about. I think that the team is now starting to align more with what his expectations were heading into the season, which was that, hey, we can hold our own. We can keep our heads above water. And perhaps maybe things break the right way. Maybe we get a couple 85th percentile outcomes from guys that we took a flyer on. And this team's a playoff team. And you see what happened with the Diamondbacks last year. They went to the World Series. And, I know that they didn't look super competitive in that World Series. But you're a couple injuries or you're a couple lucky breaks away from making that a competitive series. And we know in baseball anything can happen. I'm not suggesting that the Mets are going to the World Series, although I wouldn't object to it. I think that there's a lot of clarity to be gained throughout the month of July. If they continue to play the way that they have, I think that they will just be more of a hold, honestly, because while there are some intriguing pieces on the Mets roster, I don't know that there is anybody who gets you a haul so obvious and immediate that it then becomes you are drastically increasing your 2025 and 2026 chances. I think that that was more so what last season was, where they restocked the farm a little bit, guys like Luis Angel Acuña, in the trades for high-priced starters like Justin Verlander and Max Scherzer. So I think that they are most likely going to be a hold, maybe a reliever here and there, but there's a chance that they cut the other way. I would be surprised, honestly, if they traded Pete Alonso specifically, just because that would be such a flashpoint. That would be a really bold thing for David Stearns to do in his first season running the New York Mets. And I would just be surprised if he did that because of the lessons that he learned by trading away Josh Hader at the end of his deal with the Milwaukee Brewers when he was running that organization and had a little bit of a clubhouse revolt. I think he kind of learned a hard lesson there because the team's like, hey, man, that's our closer. And we put a lot of stock in that guy. We put a lot of faith in that guy, and that guy matters to us on a personal level. Say what you want about Josh Hader, but he was very important to that organization and anchoring that bullpen. And so I don't know. It's a really interesting, it'll be really interesting to see, because I think a lot of the ways that we praise GMs now is to be cold and calculating and to do the right thing and to set the franchise up for future success. But we also kind of ignore the fact that that is not always a known outcome.
Yeah. It's the DePoto special, right? You got to worry about the reaction to that as well. And obviously, you know, the Mets, if they did a mile bye, there are some, you know, Jose Iglesias has been a fun story. Probably ideally, like, you have the depth that Jose Iglesias isn't a huge important part of your team. Like, Ben Gamel is back in the major leagues on this Mets bench. Like, they could probably use an extra guy there as well. Let's move outside of the Mets here. We got about 5 minutes left with you, and I got to ask you. So it was brought to my attention last week that for the final game at Oakland Coliseum on September 26th, the Oakland Athletics are going to give away like 30,000 mini Oakland Coliseum figurines. And I think that that is cool and it would be a nice thing to have. However, this is the most hated ownership group in the most hated stadium and the most beleaguered fan base in definitely in baseball, maybe in North American sports right now. And yes, they have decided to give out projectiles on the final day. Can you think of a giveaway that was like worse conceived than this?
You know, I was trying to think about worst conceived, but the confluence of factors here, with it being the way that John Fisher has treated this organization over the last few years, and it being the last day, so the frustration being at its maximal point, I don't know that there is something that is more obviously dangerous. I did look it up. In 1995, the Dodgers decided to give a ball to fans entering in a game against the Cardinals at Dodger Stadium. That feels like a pretty bad idea. We may learn some lessons from that, where if 20,000 fans have a ball that they can throw onto the field at any time, that's not ideal. But I don't know. I mean, I think this is a cool giveaway. I'm hoping that fans don't use it to chuck it onto the field, because it's not like the players, you can't really throw it at John Fisher. I don't know. Maybe there's a couple fans out there who have the arm to reach the owner's suite.
He's not going to be there.
Yeah, I don't think John Fisher's going to be in attendance. Famously, my co-host Alex on Tipping Pitches, he was at an A's game a couple years ago, and he ran into John Fisher, and he asked to go take a photo with him. And Alex was wearing a T-shirt that said steal bases, not wages. And John Fisher just didn't even care, didn't pay attention to this. And so we got that photo. So that lives on famously for us over at Tipping Pitches. But I don't think John Fisher has attended a game maybe since then. So perhaps Alex was the reason that John Fisher will never attend the Oakland Coliseum again.
I think he's got a lot of reasons, including his own personal safety around there. You don't want to show up to the last dive bar in a suit and tie. I'm interested to see how that one goes. And that's a great shirt, by the way. Lots of great merch over at Tipping Pitches and a great podcast. Obviously, there's a new episode coming out today. What is the weirdest AMA question that you guys got this one or have gotten in general?
Oh, we've got a lot of really weird questions because oftentimes we don't talk all that much about baseball. We stray pretty far onto the fringes. However, I think not the weirdest question, but I think my favorite question that we got on this past episode was, when is it okay to start rooting for your team, rooting against your team, your own team?
Very relevant here.
Well, that's why I wanted to share it with you here, Blake, because I think that there is a fine line between being frustrated by your team, but still wanting to root for the guys, still wanting to root for the players, because it sucks to see the players that you like lose all of the time, but you can be frustrated with the front office and want to sort of rebuke them for how they've treated a team or how an ownership has invested in a team. But I think that that made me laugh because I've definitely been there with the Mets over the years where I'm just like, I actually hope that you guys just lose so that I can emotionally detach myself from this team in July and start paying attention to the Dodgers or start paying attention to the Mariners or start paying attention to going to the movies, you know, something besides spending 3 hours with this New York Mets team, or in your case, this Toronto Blue Jays team every night. So funny questions like that.
Yeah, well, here I would urge everyone to still lock into the games on Sportsnet, lock into Jays Talk Plus 2 hours a day. But yeah, if you are okay with the team sliding so they sell at the deadline, and then you're just happy to watch Vlad go on a heater while the games don't matter all that much, maybe that satisfies everyone. And obviously, if this were a different sport with different lottery rules and things like that, you could get even more aggressive with the rooting against your team, which we just came off of in the Raptors season here. Bobby Wagner, thanks so much for taking the time out, man.
Hey, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Bobby Wagner of Tipping Pitches, a tremendous, tremendous baseball podcast that goes into a lot of things off the field as well. A lot of the labor relations stuff, when the minor leagues were trying to unionize, those guys are really, really great. And I know we goofed around with some Grimace and Jose Iglesias, OMG stuff, Candelita stuff there, but really, really smart guys, really, really smart podcast. They get a lot of really great guests on there as well. And Alex, Bobby's co-host, was out in England for those Phillies games, which was a lot of fun to hear about what that experience was like. So thanks to him for coming on. We're going to take a break here in a second and tag in another one of our favorites at a national level, Robert Orr of Baseball Prospectus, who will check in on some of our earlier Blue Jays conversations. We'll also check in on this Astros team the Jays are going to see for four because Robert wrote a big piece on the reinvention of Hunter Brown, who we'll see tonight, and his new sinker. That's next. We'll also take your questions to 590-590 as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Hey, it's Nick Kiprios.
And I'm Justin Bourne.
We're diving deep into everything happening in Leafland and the biggest stories around the NHL.
Real Kipper and Bourne, weekdays from 4 to 6 on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays back in action at 3 o'clock today down at Rogers Center. First of four against the Houston Astros. We'll continue to set that one up for you throughout the day. No big news other than Danny Jansen to the paternity list and Brian Servin up off the taxi squad from AAA to be the backup catcher. It's Yario Rodriguez against Hunter Brown in the first of these four. The Houston Rockets. Too much NBA free agency stuff happened. The Houston Astros have won 9 of 10 to get back into the American League wildcard picture. Let's talk about those Astros. Let's talk about these Blue Jays. Let's talk to Robert Orr of Baseball Prospectus, one of our favorite guests. Robert, what's up, man? Thank you for doing this.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, man. Okay, let's start with the Jays. I mean, we talked to you a couple weeks back, and there were some positive indicators underneath poor performance, and there were some negative indicators underneath that poor performance. Zoom ahead a couple weeks. All the same stuff. Different guys performing well, different guys underperforming, but Blue Jays in the exact same spot. Are you, from a outside view, about ready to call it for this year's version of the Blue Jays?
They're in a very weird place, obviously. I'm not entirely sure what to make of them, honestly. I think it might be worth seeing, you know, running it right up until the deadline, just because of like the Bo and Vladimir impending free agency. You don't want to like start selling and maybe turn those guys off for next year. There might still be a shot at next year. I'm sure all these are conversations that have been happening over the last few months. I'm to be honest, I'm not entirely sure which way I would lean.
It's a tough one, and I know I certainly have a pulse of how the fan base wants to lean, at least based on our texts and messages and things like that lately. And you can text us to 590-590. Let us know how you're feeling on Canada Day here. But okay, let's get into some of the specific things there. And I guess probably the two headline items on a positive side for this Blue Jays team have been that Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is on an absolute heater, and George Springer seems to be turning things around a little bit. Let's start with Vlad, because he's been a fascinating case when we look at the underlying metrics for years, right? Like the exit velocities are there, but maybe the launch angle is not good enough. Maybe there's a spin component. His damage rate, which is a stat you do at Baseball Prospectus, which kind of takes all the different batted ball stuff into account for each individual event and says, hey, forget launch angle, exit velocity separately. Let's look at it as one batted ball. That had been on a bit of a four-year decline as well. And now we're starting to see, though, it's coming around. Six homers in the last nine, driving in a ton of runs. That damage rate is up to the 91st percentile, according to the latest. I've looked at your metrics. What are you seeing in Vlad's turnaround of late?
Earlier in the year, he was, like, doing the right stuff under the hood, and I'm not sure he was getting the results that it warranted. And it just seems to be, you know, all catching up to him now. You mentioned the damage rate. That is his best one since that 2021 season. So that's definitely something you want to see. He's just making really good decisions at the plate. Always, you know, never struck out too much. And I haven't dug into like the ground ball rate or anything, but I would guess he's elevating the ball more effectively lately.
Yeah, he certainly is. And, you know, that's it's been pretty fun to see because, you know, obviously, like, look, when he's hitting for, when he's like locked in, a lot of times it looks like it doesn't necessarily look like a 40 homer hitter locked in. It looks like a 320 hitter locked in, right? Like he's like, sometimes he looks like a really powerful contact hitter, but now they're just like, yeah, they're getting out. It's been fun to see on the George Springer side. Look, the season long metrics are still not particularly great. June was about to be the worst month of his entire career. I guess my question for you on Springer, and this doesn't have to be specific to Springer, but in general, we now have access to this bat speed data, and we don't know year over year. We haven't, like we're still fairly limited in information. But when you see George Springer start to turn things around a little bit, and we here have heard from the team, hey, we were seeing good stuff under the hood. The fact that his bat speed has increased incrementally month over month, do you think that that's something, once we have more data on bat speed, is going to be a helpful indicator for guys making in-season changes?
I think it's another piece of information that's always useful. I think one thing it might be particularly useful for a guy like Springer is as an indicator of health or fitness in being in good game shape. He's always picked up the little nicks and bruises. So if the bat speed is trending up, he's probably in pretty good shape. Feeling good and playing good. I think last time we talked, he was also coming off his best week of the season before that point. So maybe you just got to bring me on every week to get the best out of George Springer. I don't know. But he was doing the right things then. And I said, I would expect better from him, but it didn't seem to happen for a while. Maybe this one is the one that will turn this season around. I'm not, we'll see.
And because this is the Toronto Blue Jays in 2024, only two players are allowed to be good at the same time. For a little while there was David Schneider and Danny Jansen. Now it's Vlad and George Springer. I'd imagine there will be like a Bo Bichette, Alejandro Kirk month or a couple weeks later in the season, but only two at a time. And I mentioned David Schneider because he's in now probably the coldest stretch of his career, but he's a guy who still, when we look at your damage rate metric, your Seager metric, that selective aggression, he's still like, the process is still really, really strong. Where is your confidence level in a guy like David Schneider who doesn't have a huge major league sample in terms of overall plate appearances, but what we have seen is like so strong from a process and hitting the ball hard standpoint?
I saw he still rates pretty well on damage, but it's definitely dipped lately. And one thing with a guy with his profile, who's just like, he's very single-minded on pulling fly balls, which, that's great, but that can be a pretty streaky profile if a guy's timing is off, because you have to catch the ball right out front of the plate every time, right, just right to do that. And pitchers wise up to that, they change the way they attack, and it's up to him to adjust back. I think I saw he was in like a 2-for-20 or something slump lately. He definitely has like the skills needed to adjust as far as like pitch recognition and a feel for the zone. But it's up to him to make those changes. I guess you gotta just wait and see if he can do that.
Yeah, it's kind of, this is something you mentioned, the pull fly ball and catching it out front. This is something where Isak Paredes, for example, who's like obviously the archetype of this, well, pitchers started pitching him outside more, and now he just like hovers over the plate. Like he's borderline standing on the plate so we can get to that outside stuff. And I dug in on the numbers last week, and David Schneider is actually seeing more pitches on that outer third of the plate than he's ever seen before. So, when he first came up, the book on him was, well, pound him high with velocity and let's see if a 5'9" guy who was, saw a big spike in walk rate with the challenge system in the minor leagues, let's see if he can handle that. He handled it okay, and now pitchers have kind of gone to, let's see if he can get around on something. He actually, a couple weeks back hit his first home run to the opposite field as a major leaguer. So there's some signs he's going to figure it out. But for right now, a little tough. Could be tough today against Hunter Brown. And David Schneider is in the lineup. We'll go through the lineups with you a little later, guys. Hunter Brown is on the hill for the Astros. He's a guy that you wrote about last week at Baseball Prospectus. Tell us about the reinvention. This is pretty dramatic as far as making a change to your repertoire in the middle of the season goes.
His is a really interesting case because he went from throwing four-seam fastballs to right-handers to he has steadily become a exclusively sinker fastballer against right-handed hitters. And it's not even an especially great sinker. Like, it's 96 miles an hour, has a good bit of movement, but it's not like, you know, Clay Holmes or something like that. But what it did is it opened up his entire arsenal, because everything he had moved to his glove side, and the sinker moves to his arm side. So that means that hitters have to actually cover the entire plate. So adding that one pitch basically gave hitters, it changed the entire way they had to approach at-bats against him, at least right-handed hitters, because he still throws the four-seam fastball to lefties. But yeah, that single pitch, it's righties are not able to just like crowd the plate. They have to respect the inside of the zone now. And it's made everything else that he throws a little bit more effective. Like he's got this hard slider cutter that he throws to righties and a curveball. And those both break away because of that sinker. Guys are coming up short on swings against those pitches.
So we've examined a couple guys like this recently, because we just saw the Red Sox, right? And the Red Sox organizationally have basically been like, unless you're Nick Pivetta and you have like a top three fastball in baseball, stop throwing the four seamer, throw a sinker or a cutter or both instead. And I know you linked to a couple pieces from Justin Choi, who we've had on the show from Fangraphs, talking about how more and more pitchers are having two, maybe even three different fastball variations. How does that, like one of the most interesting things about your article was that since he started throwing the sinker, it's not just about necessarily the weak contact on the sinker, sawing off at a righty's hands. It's that he's getting more chase on that knuckle curve, on the changeup, on the slider. How do those different pitches interplay? And just like, I mean, obviously, like we have Chris Bassitt here. We know throwing a fifth or sixth pitch or something like that gives you some variability that makes you harder to predict. But it does seem in Hunter Brown's case that replacing some four seamers with the sinker has made his other stuff tougher to pick up.
Yeah, it just means because everything broke basically one way that he threw before, even if guys guessed the wrong pitch, they'd be swinging to the right place on the plate, if that makes sense. So, you know, they might not barrel it up, but he had like a 400-something BABIP against, because guys were just, you know, getting mishits that dropped into the field instead of whiffs, basically. So with the sinker and the way that it moves being completely different once it breaks to everything else, guys have to wait an extra beat, if that makes sense, to figure out which pitch it is and where it's going to be on the play, without, so that they don't look really foolish when they swing the completely wrong way. And yeah, that extra second that they have to wait leads to a lot more chases out of the zone, guys just getting fooled more often. Yeah, it just creates more doubt in the hitter's mind. It upsets their timing. That's really the whole point of pitching.
And he's been pretty terrific since. So it's been 10 starts since he introduced that sinker. And while his surface numbers, if you're a Jays fan, you're looking at 4.37 ERA, 1.37 WHIP, this might be, 2.20 ERA over his last 10 starts, including 65 strikeouts in 57 and a third inning. So pretty good stuff for Hunter Brown there. I didn't give you this question ahead of time. This is actually a two-part question. And the first is, I know you're a Phillies guy. Are you an Always Sunny in Philadelphia person?
I've only seen a little bit of it. Okay. I haven't. Pretty bad fandom of me not to have watched all that yet.
That's okay. I have a very good Spencer Arrighetti joke for tomorrow based on Always Sunny, but I'll save it for then. However, we're going to see Spencer Arrighetti tomorrow. What have you made of him? I asked Eno about this a couple weeks ago too. I can't get a read on him. He's a guy that, like, sorry to talk about fantasy teams for people who don't care about that, but like, I've streamed him a couple times and he's like dominating good teams, being awful against bad teams. Some days the strikeout stuff's there, some days it's not. He's been a tough one to figure out. And I realize if the Astros were healthy, he's probably not even in the rotation right now, but they've got a whole rotation worth of guys on the IL. What have you made from his start this year?
He's a guy that I've liked in the minors. A friend of mine is a big Astros fan and highlighted him as a prospect to me. So I've watched a little bit of him before, and he actually gives me a lot of like Lance McCullers vibes aesthetically. Like, he's got the long hair. His best pitch is his curve. I really like that pitch. I'm not sure what the ceiling is for him. He strikes me as a guy who, like, kind of like Hunter Brown, needs to keep working on the repertoire to get to where he needs to be. Because the starts have been a real roller coaster this year. I think he had like 7 shutout innings with 10 Ks in his last start, and the one before that he got completely lit up. So it's kind
by
of
the
flip
White
a coin
Sox and the Tigers.
Yeah, that's a really hard one to get a read on. So he's definitely not a finished product, but he's got a lot of breaking pitches, which makes him kind of an interesting pitcher to watch. That's not really answering your question much about what I make of him, but
I mean, it confirms to me that me not being able to get a read on him is fair. Again, you're shutting down the Guardians and the Giants and the Mariners and then getting teed off on by the White Sox and the Tigers. I don't know, man. I don't know what to do about that. Okay, like Cal Quantrill's had a similar season, but that is also just like you're the Rockies, so of course you're going to get teed off on by the White Sox sometimes. Big picture with this Astros team, they have been able to win 9 of their last 10 to get back within 3.5 of the wild card. Obviously, that's still a big hill to climb, a couple of teams for them to jump. But they were, you know, a month ago maybe in the same spot as the Blue Jays, which was, well, we're so heavily leveraged on this year, it would be really, really tough to turn and be sellers. We got to get back in this race. Do you think the Astros have done enough? And do you believe that there is enough there with the Astros to make it back? You know, this is a pretty good playoff streak that organization's on here.
Definitely. I think the time period you were referencing, I think Dana Brown, their GM, went on TV broadcasts, said we will not be sellers, pretty unequivocally clear there. I mean, everyone I talk to expects them to still win that division. Even when, like, the Mariners, I think, had, like, a 10-game division lead, nobody that I had spoken to anywhere really had counted the Astros as down and out even at that point. And yeah, they've just completely turned it around, all of this without Kyle Tucker, which is kind of wild. So they'll be getting him back. It's kind of a big deal. Verlander at some point, I think they probably are going to be buyers. They'll probably be looking for a starting pitcher because the pitching has been a little bit down compared to Astros teams we're used to watching the last 8 years. But I think they're still the Astros. Rumors of their downfall were a little bit exaggerated there.
Yeah, I think sometimes it's maybe a little bit of people hoping for it when it comes to an organization that's maybe not the most well-liked around baseball, you know?
Yeah, some wishful thinking involved there, definitely.
Yeah, which is, you can understand it, even if, it's not accurate. I keep saying they're 3.5 back of the final wild card. They're also only 3.5 back of the Mariners now, so that AL West firmly in play there as well. And I guess the other thing to take away is, you mentioned it, they've done this without Kyle Tucker, so they should probably trade him. You know, a team like the Blue Jays that's selling, you send out Kyle Tucker, you get back some help for right now, right?
Yeah, definitely. I they might be having that very conversation as we speak.
Yeah, I don't think so. Okay, let's pivot to the NL. I wanted to ask about your Phillies because they've had an interesting couple weeks here with some negative stuff sprinkled in there, so some tough breaks on the injury front, but also some really good stuff, including extending Christopher Sanchez on what looks like a pretty good deal, and then he goes out and throws a complete game shutout right away. Did you like the Christopher Sanchez extension? And, I mean, just really locking in what's probably the best rotation in baseball.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely nothing to complain about with the extension. That's a great deal for the Phillies, and apparently it was, like, his idea. He told the agent to go talk to the Phillies about it. Dave Dombrowski was like, we don't normally do contract stuff in season, but they wanted to. So got that knocked out. Yeah, he had a heck of a week because he signed that on Saturday, you know, life-changing money. And then that Sunday he threw 7 innings of 1-run ball. And then his next start was a complete game shutout. That's a pretty nice week.
It certainly is. I would love a week like that.
Same. But, yeah, and then locking up the rotation. The only guy not under contract for a while right now is Ranger Suarez, who's kind of had a little bit of a rough patch, but he was never going to keep up that, like, 1968 Bob Gibson line that he was running for most of the year. The pitching is a joy to watch every day. The lineup's been a little less enjoyable to watch the last few days without basically every bat that could hit a home run, but they're making do.
When it comes to Sanchez, he's had such a fascinating road to get to this point. And, like, he was in rookie ball at 17. So, like, we're talking, it's been a decade of this coming. He was on the fringes enough that Tampa Bay, the team who always finds the Christopher Sanchez, trade him away for, I think, Curtis Meade was the trade return. So not a whole lot back there, as much as a fan as I am of a good beer. Meade, not enough for Christopher Sanchez here. And then a couple of up and down seasons. What do we learn from the Christopher Sanchez story to this point when it comes to, you know, player development and specifically starting pitcher development? I wonder if there's anything we can take from him other than just, man, be patient if a guy has the stuff.
I mean, that's kind of the lesson I was going to take away from it, is that because he's always had a really good changeup, and his velocity is weird because, like, he got up to the mid-90s as a prospect, but it was going to the backstop every other pitch, it seemed like. He got better a year ago when he lost a bunch of weight and wasn't able to throw that hard, and that's how his command basically improved. And then this year, he got the velocity back and the command gains stuck. I don't know if that's really a plan that I would want to repeat for every pitching prospect, but the basic thing here is that his changeup was really good and he had a pretty good sinker this whole time. And he just, once he was able to learn how to locate those slightly better, it all kind of came together for him. But again, yeah, not a very linear progression at all.
So you mentioned the Phillies have had some all their home run hitters are on the IL. JT Realmuto, Kyle Schwarber, and Bryce Harper hit it on the same day. Maybe not a ton of long-term concern because they've banked some wins here in the National League East. They've got a bit of a cushion there over the Braves by, what, 9-8 games, I think?
I think it's 8,
yeah.
I think.
So right now, they're in triage mode. So, like, Johan Rojas is back up. Cody Clemens is off the IL, destroyer of worlds, Cody Clemens. The other one I thought about is, and maybe he just would have moved to a bench role and someone else would have gone down, but did Whit Merrifield maybe get like and I asked because he's a former Blue Jay, obviously, and we liked him here, but it kind of seemed like he was maybe close to, if not a DFA, to like not playing very much there before all these spots in the lineup opened up.
Yeah, he was playing a lot less when everyone was healthy, even after like Rojas was sent down. They've been giving a lot of time to David Dahl lately, which probably isn't a great alternative either. But yeah, Merrifield, it looks kind of rough. He's not hitting the ball very hard. It's a lot of lazy flies. He's not like striking out. He's actually walking a decent amount too. So it's kind of the skills at the plate are still there. The eye is still there. Decisions are okay, but he just can't impact the ball with much authority, even relative to what he used to do, which wasn't a lot to begin with. So it's just a lot of non-competitive, like lazy flies and line drives directly to outfielders. It's not sure if there's a turnaround waiting to happen.
Okay, last Phillies one for you. Will Jazz Chisholm pay for his crimes? For anyone who didn't see, he stole the Philly Fanatics ATV and was just riding it around the field the other day.
Well, I think he had a pretty decent game after that. They won that game. I think he had a big hit in that. So that's not going to dissuade him from doing that in the future.
Certainly not. Okay, last one before I let you go in seriousness. This is staying in the NL East. I know you keep an eye on top prospects and things like that. We're going to see James Wood up today, one of the top 3 to 5 prospects in all of baseball for the Washington Nationals. Your excitement level to see him, and what are you looking for from, obviously a bat with all the upside in the world, but make his major league debut here at 21.
I mean, the tools are all there. I think he cut down his strikeout rate really a lot in minors this year compared to where it had been. That's probably going to be the big key for him. If he keeps that under like 30%, it's probably going to be really great because he absolutely pulverizes the ball and he can run and play center field at like 6'7", which is, he's just a freak. But I'm definitely excited to watch. My fiance is a Mets fan, so I'm sure we'll have that game on, and I don't know if she'll be quite as happy if he hits like a home run on his debut, but it'll definitely be interesting to watch.
Well, the red hot Mets. So there you go. You guys, I'd imagine the NL East relationship isn't always easy to navigate, but Mets as a wild card team, Phillies as a division winner. I don't know. Maybe there's enough room for both this year.
As long as they don't play in the playoffs, I think we're okay.
Okay.
But that seems like that might happen if that's the case. And I really don't know what. Maybe I'll go to my parents' house and watch that.
Well, I lean Phillies in this case, but you know, we'll see where it's at. We'll see where it's at when Kyle Schwarber and Bryce Harper and JT Realmuto all get back healthy. That would be the big thing there. Robert, thanks for taking the time out this morning, man. Enjoy that game. Enjoy your, I guess I was going to say long weekend. It's a long weekend here, but you guys just get the Thursday off, right? Or do you get Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday?
It's just Thursday, but like nobody works on a Friday when you have Thursday off and then the weekend.
Perfect. So. All right, man. Exactly. Well, thanks for taking the time. Enjoy the long weekend that's ahead for you.
Thanks. You too.
Robert Orr of Baseball Prospectus. Make sure you're subscribed over there, checking out all their great work. He also did some great stuff recently on the offensive environment and baseball being down and looking at some of the potential reasons why. And yeah, we've talked a lot about it over the course of this season. We talked to Dr. Meredith Wills about the baseballs potentially being a factor. We've talked about the weather environments, a couple teams changing their park dimensions, the drag on the ball and things like that. The positioning of outfielders, limiting batting average on balls in play and cutting down the number of doubles. All these things are real. And then the main thing that everyone seems to come back to at the very end is, man, pitchers are just so good. They have, and what Robert's piece went into is kind of how the decline in pitchers throwing bad pitches that they shouldn't throw in those situations. So, you know, a slider righty to lefty where you, if you have a really good slider, you could drop that thing back foot. You can get it in righty to lefty or lefty to righty. But generally speaking, those pitches have big platoon splits. So maybe you dial back on those. And like Hunter Brown has, who we'll see later today, maybe you want something that cuts back the other way for going against same-handed pitchers. Maybe throw the changeup or the splitter a little bit more in split neutral situations. And so in addition to stuff is harder, stuff breaks more, the outfielders are better positioned, et cetera, pitchers have also just gotten smarter about what they throw to whom and when, which is frustrating if you're an offensive player, I'm sure. And frustrating if you just want high-scoring baseball games. Although the Blue Jays have given you a ton of those recently. They've been on the wrong side of some of those. They've been on the right side of some of those. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll see if they're going to be on the right or wrong side of this four set against the Houston Astros. We'll set the series up. We'll take a look back at some of my favorite games from the Blue Jays history on Canada Day. I went back over the last 20 years of Canada Day games and pulled some notes on some of my favorites there. I will also answer some of your texts to 590, 590. So keep those coming. All that's next as we continue this Canada Day edition of Jays Talk Plus on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
The best Blue Jays show out there, period. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. What do Yariel Rodriguez and Ty Tobenheim have in common? Probably not a ton. But today, Yariel Rodriguez will toe the rubber at home on Canada Day, which is something way back in 2006, Ty Tobenheim did. Why am I talking about Ty Tobenheim? Well, I love the Canada Day game, and I went back through 20 years of Blue Jays history of playing on July 1st and pulled some notes from some of my favorites over the years. We'll sprinkle those in over this final segment. We will also sprinkle in some of your texts to 590. 590. I mentioned Yariel Rodriguez, a great piece from Shai Davidi up at sportsnet.ca this morning about how talking to Yariel Rodriguez about getting this Canada Day start and how, you know, this is kind of another marker for him in his journey from Cuba through Japan to the Dominican, now to Major League Baseball, and what that means to him. So great work from Shai, some great stuff from Yariel Rodriguez as well. Now, what do we expect from Yariel Rodriguez? That's a little bit of a tougher one to answer. So he was obviously on the IL with a back issue, made a couple really encouraging rehab starts in the minor leagues. A lot of swing and miss stuff down there. Not the most pitch efficient. He wasn't going super long into games, but a lot of strikeouts, a lot of strong performances there. And then he comes up, and in one and a third innings against Cleveland, he gets touched up pretty badly, and Bowden Francis has to relieve him in the second inning. Then he pitches against Boston, and the game gets rained out after an inning. So we really haven't seen much of Yariel Rodriguez since he returned. And maybe you'd be a little worried about him being stretched out after throwing just one and a third and then one inning. In that rainout game, he did throw a couple of simulated innings in a bullpen afterward to make sure he remains stretched out. So that is a positive. This is, however, the Blue Jays' 11th game day in a row. And what comes with that, even with some roster churn, is that the bullpen has been used a lot. Most notably on a day that Yariel Rodriguez is going to start. Bowden Francis has pitched three of the last 4 days. Don't know how available Bowden Francis might be or how long they'd be willing to use him for. Jose Kwas, who's fresh up from AAA, also pitched each of the last 2 days. I would imagine he is, if not red, then a deep yellow on that bullpen chart today. Hennessy Cabrera, Nate Pearson, and Chad Green all also pitched yesterday. Nate Pearson has thrown 36 pitches over the weekend, so he's probably someone they wouldn't want to lean on for a ton of length today either, but this is the situation the bullpen is in. This is why you're trading for Yeri Rodriguez. This is why something like Ryan Burr hitting the IL or Hagen Danner hitting the IL at the AAA level is concerning. You know, Brandon Iser could be back at some point if someone hits the IL. Eric Swanson is down there, but not pitching particularly well. And then, yeah, there are a bunch of non-40-man guys who are of some interest. I broke down a couple on Blue Jay Central on the weekend. You look at Connor Cook, who has, you know, not the greatest ERA and whip, but it's trended in the right direction, and he has a big wipeout slider that you can – it's at least something that you can look at and build on, at least looking forward, maybe not right now, but maybe a little later in the year, certainly for 2025 and beyond. You can look at Hayden Yinger, who's been pretty good of late. Mason Flaherty, who is probably the system's best lefty-on-lefty reliever, but still has pretty significant platoon splits. So, you know, if this were the era of the Loogie, the lefty one-out guy, then maybe Mason Flaherty would be up here already. But as it is right now, they probably have some platoon concerns there. And then Eric Pardino, who we've talked about a lot on this show because it's such a good story, formerly one of the Jays' top prospects in the entire system as a starter, now has gotten back to AAA as a reliever, coming off a AA performance where he had a 101 ERA over 27 innings and had a very big strikeout rate. Bit of a rough start at AAA so far, but that's kind of what you'd expect there. So anyway, that's the state of the bullpen and the bullpen depth. Tim Mayza obviously now DFA'd. Jordan Romano going to see Dr. Keith Meister, the Keith Meister, tomorrow. Not great there either. At least Jimmy Garcia sounds like he's trending relatively in the right direction. So Yariel Rodriguez probably getting leaned on for a little bit more length today. And then the Jays, yeah, going to have to lean on a pretty overworked and undermanned bullpen right now to get through this one. And this is an Astros team that, again, comes in pretty hot, 9-1 in their last 10. Overall on the season, they're 42-41. So they're only 3.5 back of the wild card, 3.5 back of Seattle in the AL West. They're 11th in the league in runs scored, but they're kind of like the Jays last year, where the actual run total is lower than some of the underlying metrics. And I know last year nobody wanted to hear any more of that, even though it turned around eventually with the runners in scoring position and things like that. The Astros are 11th in runs per game, but they're 5th in OPS. They're 7th in weighted runs created plus. They're 8th in home runs. They're even league average at stolen bases. So while they do have Kyle Tucker on the IL right now, as well as a boatload of pitchers, this is an offense that's been able to get it done for the most part and certainly been able to get it done lately. Their issue has been more preventing runs. The starting rotation has the 20th best ERA in baseball. The bullpen's been a little better than that. They're 12th in runs allowed per game, so they've been able to cobble it together. Hunter Brown has been a big find for them over the last 10. We talked about it a little bit with Robert Orr. He has a 4.37 ERA and a 1.37 whip on the season, but 10 games ago, he started introducing a sinker. And the sinker itself is not the most unbelievable pitch in the world, but trading out some of a mediocre four-seam fastball for more of a sinker, especially against right-handed hitters, seems to have opened something up for Hunter Brown. The sinker has had slightly better results than the four-seamer, and it seems to help that knuckle curve, that changeup, that slider play up because it moves a little differently and just gives hitters an extra plane and an extra direction of movement they have to be aware of. So over his last 10 starts since introducing that sinker, Hunter Brown has a 2.20 ERA and 65 strikeouts in 57 innings. So pretty good numbers there. His changeup is very good in general. It's the 85th percentile in terms of run value for an off-speed pitch. It has big swing and miss rates, as does the knuckle curve. And then he has just really good batted ball metrics overall. Like underneath the hood, there were a lot of warning signs. Again, if you're a fantasy player, this is something you probably look at. Hunter Brown had an ERA up around 5, and then underlying metrics that were like, nah, this guy pitches like a 3.50 ERA guy by low. We talked to Eno Saris about it a couple weeks ago, and yeah, it's turned around significantly for Hunter Brown. So you can look at some of the season-long numbers they'll probably tell you a mixed story. So I cut this off since the introduction of his sinker. Against righties, he'll lead with that sinker. That's his number one pitch. He'll also throw some four seamers and some cutters, slider, and that knuckle curve. Against lefties, he'll stay with that four seamer, and then it's a lot of that changeup. He'll throw that knuckle curve to lefties regardless. And then, yeah, he'll throw a cutter and a slider. So five pitches to be aware of on either side of that. The Jays have seen Hunter Brown before. I saw him on June 6th last year. He gave up three earned over six innings. And here's a weird one for you. So the Jays as a whole, the guys who are active today, have seen him for 19 plate appearances. They have three hits off of him, and they are all home runs. So that's a bit of an odd one. That is Dalton Varsho, George Springer, and Isaiah Kiner-Falefa have all homered off of him. And all three of those guys will be in the lineup today. The Astros, of course, have not seen Yariel Rodriguez yet in his major league career. So yeah, let's look at that Jays lineup right now. It's Bo Bichette and Spencer Horwitz at the top, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., Justin Turner cleaning up and at the DH spot. He also, as Hazel May tweeted out, has some very nice Canada Day cleats on for today as well. He'll be followed by George Springer in right, Dalton Varsho in center, David Schneider in left, Alejandro Kirk catching because, again, Danny Jansen's on the paternity list. Brian Servin up as catcher depth there. And then Isaiah Kiner-Falefa plays third and rounds it out. Sorry, hiccups. Brian Servin, by the way, was, you've seen him up at the major league level this year, was actually hitting pretty well at AAA. He's not a guy who, you know, you have to go back to the lower levels of the minors since for the last time that he was like a bat plus catcher, but he's actually having a pretty nice season with Buffalo. He's hitting 270 with almost a 400 on base percentage down there and almost an 800 OPS. So he'll probably with another seven games in a row, I don't know, maybe they'll have Alejandro Kirk catch them and Danny Jansen only misses a day or two. But if you see Brian Servin in there, he's been having an okay year at the plate. So that'd be interesting to see. And then, yeah, Alejandro Kirk is going to be leaned on a lot more here. So it is Canada Day. I'm obviously in my Canada basketball jacket here from Casey Bannerman, which is just a very sharp look. I thought about wearing the Casey Bannerman Canada basketball jersey and just letting the arms out today. Didn't know how they would feel about that. On this show, I could probably get away with it, maybe. Like if McAfee can do it all the time, maybe I could get away with it. But on Blue Jay Central later, where I'll be talking about a little bit more CanCon, some of the Canadian prospects in the Jays system that are standing out right now, Adam Mackle, Connor O'Halloran, who there will be a nice feature on Blue Jay Central later. I don't think I could have got away with just a basketball jersey. So instead, it's the Casey Bannerman jacket. It's very sharp. I like it. Fits the day. So I mentioned it earlier. I went back and I looked at the last 20 years of the Blue Jays on Canada Day. And I should have cut it off at 15 years because what started happening when I went back further was something that annoyed me even as a teenager. When the Blue Jays used to not play at home on Canada Day, what in the world were the baseball schedule makers thinking? So since 2011, they have played at home on Canada Day every single year, except for 2020 when there was a pandemic and the season didn't start until later in July. But I went back 2004, 2005, 2007, 2008, 2010. They played on the road. I know schedule making is very, very difficult, but there are 2 days on the calendar that are national holidays here in the summer where you could get pretty much a guaranteed sellout, and they're not holidays in the U.S. Biggest layup on the board, put the Jays at home on Canada Day. So in those last 20 years, again, five of the games on the road, we'll throw those out. Who cares what they were doing on the road? And again, they're back from 2010 and earlier. 1 year scrapped because of the pandemic. And then the 14 games they played, they went 7-7. So not bad. You'd like it to be a little better. Last year, they lost to the Sox. Justin Turner actually homered off Eric Swanson in the ninth for insurance runs there. George Springer, Bo Bichette, and Matt Chapman all homered in that game. There are some fun ones in the past. 2 years ago, they beat the brakes off the Rays 9-2. Lourdes Gurriel had three hits and a home run. A pretty good Jose Berríos game. We got Platinum Max Castillo for a couple games to mop up. And Sergio Romo pitched in that game, if you remember his brief stint with the Blue Jays. Back in 2021, they lost to Seattle, and someone named Shed Long Jr. homered. I don't really remember that guy for the Mariners, Shed Long Jr. Semien homered on the Blue Jays side, and there was a long list of relievers that you barely remember in that one. There are some other fun ones from over the years, and also just like remember some guys. So we're going to do that. We're going to look at some of those. So 2019, they beat the Kansas City Royals 11-4. Teoscar homered in that one. Freddie Galvis had a pair of home runs in that one. Eric Sogard led off, and Clayton Richard started for the Blue Jays. So, yeah, again, we're gonna get deeper here. You think Clayton Richard's a deep pull? You just wait. 2018, they got hammered by Detroit 9-1. Nick Castellanos and Jacoby Jones homered for the Tigers. Jays only managed 6 hits. Devin Travis had 2 of them. J.A. Happ got shelled, and that required our pal John Axford to pitch in relief on Canada Day as a Canadian, which is probably pretty fun for him. I should have had him on to remember that one, but what are you going to do? I didn't think of it until right now. 2017, they lost to the Red Sox 7-1. Another ugly one where there's not a lot to think about. Like, the top of the order was Batista, Russell Martin, Josh Donaldson, which is, you know, fun, but also the bottom of the order was Darwin Barney and Ryan Gomes. So the order thins out there. Steven Pierce actually homered in that one for the Blue Jays before they traded him to the Red Sox. And here's a name that pitched out of the bullpen after Francisco Liriano pitched. And I have next to no recollection of his 19 appearances for the Blue Jays in 2017. But Jeff Béliveau getting into that one for the Jays, sure. And then, of course, there's 2016, which is probably the most memorable Canada Day game. They lost 2-1 to Cleveland in 19 innings. Lonnie Chisenhall had 5 hits. Carlos Santana homered, because of course he did. He was against the Blue Jays. The Cleveland team had 15 hits and 3 walks, but only managed 2 runs. The Jays had 11 hits and 8 walks, only managed 1 run. That came on a Justin Smoke homer. Tulowitzki and Darwin Barney each had 3 hits. Ryan Goins and Darwin Barney both pitched in that game because it went 19 innings. Jabba Chamberlain pitched in that game, if you remember that name, not for the Blue Jays, obviously, but you know, Blue Jays minor league legend Jabba Chamberlain. All sorts of nonsense in that 2016 one. I'll go through a few other names that I came across in doing this as well. I went back as far as 2004. I wanted a nice round number of 20 years. In 2006, they beat the Phillies. Troy Glaus and Eric Hinsky homered. That was the Ty Tobenheim start. And Pete Walker picked up a hold in that one. So that's a fun one. 2009 and 2011, those were consecutive ones. Ricky Romero got the nod in both of those. I've talked to him about those Canada Day starts and what they meant to him in the past, which is always a lot of fun. In 2009, he threw 8 shutout innings. Jays beat Tampa 5-0. Rod Barajas, Adam Lind, and Scott Rolen all homered in that one. And then 2011, they lost. Frankie Francisco blew a save in the 9th, but Eric Thames and Jose Bautista had both homered in that one. Also, you know, it's a weird game, that one, because John McDonald made an error, which couldn't have happened all that often. All right, what else do we got here? There are some, I mean, I've mentioned almost all of them, so just for the sake of completeness. 2012, they lost 10-6 to the Angels. Aaron Laffey pitched in that one. And a rookie, Mike Trout, homered in that game, leading off for the Angels. 2013, 2014, 2015, they won 3 in a row. This has been pretty rare for them to go on a run of Canada Day games like that. 2013, they beat the Tigers, who got a homer from Prince Fielder in that one. Jose Reyes and Mark DeRosa homered for the Blue Jays. The top of the order was Jose Reyes, Rajai Davis, and they both picked up a bunch of hits in that one. 2014, it was Jose Bautista and Colby Rasmus homering as Drew Hutchison outpitched Marco Estrada, who was with the Milwaukee Brewers still at that point, in a 4-1 win. And then 2015, they hammered the Red Sox 11-2. Mookie Betts had a homer on the Red Sox side, but Edwin homered, Jose Bautista homered, Josh Donaldson homered, Justin Smoke homered twice, and Mark Burley threw an absolute gem. So a lot of fun games throughout the history of the Blue Jays on Canada Day here at home. 7-7 over the last 14. I didn't go back any further than that because they started playing a bunch of road games. But hopefully today is a W, and that will be 8-7 over the last 15 then. Couple texts in the text line to send us in to this game. Let's save the big picture ones for tomorrow. Because, yeah, those are Larry in Mississauga says, Happy Canada Day. Thanks, man. You too. Tim in Hamilton asks, are we getting to a point where a starting pitcher needs to have 4-plus pitches? Need, not necessarily, but there's certainly good evidence. Like, there's a reason Kevin Gausman as, and he's not a two-pitch pitcher. He's always throwing that slider. But there's a reason he came into this year toying with the sinker, trying to add a two-seamer. And some of that is because hitters are catching up and you've got to kind of stay on the edge like that. You're trying to adjust before they adjust, which is something Kevin Gausman told me when I wrote about that new pitch. But also, yeah, you've got to, you know, it also protects you if you're a fastball splitter guy and your fastball has a little bit of loss in, you know, miles per hour or something like that, or the splitter just loses a little bit of depth. If you have more things you can go to, that insulates you a little bit more. To Tim's question, you know, what we're seeing is, at least if you don't have an elite four-seam fastball, you're probably better off learning how to sink or cut one of those fastballs, you know, throw at least a different fastball so that hitters can't sit on, you know, a particular type of fastball. So, I don't know if it's an absolute must that you have to have four plus pitches, but I certainly think we're seeing the people who, you know, Chris Bassitt is always going to be the exception as a guy with eight pitches who can spin the ball like crazy, could probably throw like 12 pitches if he wanted to. But the guys who have four, five, even six pitches, like a Hunter Brown today, like a Yariel Rodriguez today, yeah, I think that's going to be a way that teams try to build this, at least with the guys who have the capacity to spin that many pitches and learn that many pitches. Mike in Peterborough asks, is Mark Burley busy? Could he give us a few innings? There is nothing I would love more than to see Mark Burley back on a mound, man. One of my all-time favorites to watch. And it still crushes me that he came up less than an inning shy of the 200 inning season a couple of years back. Someone who didn't sign there said, enjoying watching Blake Murphy on Canada Day. After how many years do we admit that Ross Atkins is not capable of producing a team that's a perennial World Series contender? I mean, this has kind of been the conversation of the show for the last month, maybe even the entire season. There are big picture questions about the front office after the season and even heading into the trade deadline. There are some things that they have done an okay job of, but also they're very, very expensive. The window is kind of closing. They don't have their core stars locked up to extensions, which maybe you're fine with given what the price tag would be, but they're expensive. They're not particularly good at the major league level. The farm system is not particularly good. They have not drafted and developed super well. There are a lot of big question marks there, as we've talked about a bunch. Scott in Richmond Hill says, I knew we would regret letting Gurriel Jr. walk, and here we are. I mean, I wouldn't say you let him walk. You traded him away for as part of the Dalton Varsho package. He's been, pretty good. And then he signed. Varsho's been pretty good, rather. A bit of a cold stretch this last month or so. But obviously the defensive value is there. And Varsho's had a nice season overall. The other thing is, you know, first you have to trade something to get something. And we can relitigate the Lourdes Gurriel and Gabriel Moreno for Dalton Varsho trade a bunch. And as someone who likes Varsho, I didn't love that trade at the time because I love every catching prospect who's ever existed. Give me a catcher who you tell me is, I like Gabriel Moreno, but whatever. Lourdes Gurriel also then signed a 3-year, $42 million deal after the season and has been a league average hitter this year. Like he's got a 723 OPS. It's not, I think if you wanted to make that case about Teoscar Hernandez, who only makes a little bit more than Lourdes Gurriel Jr. and has really, really hit well for the Dodgers, I think I would hear that one more than Lourdes Gurriel Jr. Because for Teoscar, you know, you got Eric Swanson back, who was good for a little bit and is now struggling down in AAA. Adam Macko, who's probably your best healthy starter, at least from a prospect perspective, in the minors. But Teoscar has had a much better season than Lourdes Gurriel Jr. And I think, always felt to me like a longer-term piece. And I was a little more surprised to see him go than I was Gurriel. Teoscar, by the way, he's got a significantly better season so far. 18 home runs, 16 doubles, and an OPS up around 800 for a very, very good Dodgers team. Neil in Ajax asks, midpoint of the season, does any Blue Jay get an A for their performance this year? That's a good question. Should we maybe do report cards later in the week or something like that? I know someone asked them someone didn't ask. Someone just dropped their own report cards into the text line last week. I did not read them all. I apologize to whoever did that. I mean, you'd give an A to some of the like part-time guys, like Spencer Horwitz has come up and been really good, with the exception of, you know, a couple defensive things that you expect for a guy still learning a new position. I think relative to expectations, you probably give an A- maybe to Isaiah Kiner-Falefa or something like that, you know, a 758 OPS. that's the best mark of his career so far. Really good defense around the diamond. You could even go to an A for Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, but none of the guys who, you know, matter the most and move the needle the most for this team. Actually, I would probably put Chris Bassett in there. Like, over the last 10 starts, he's been unbelievable. He started the season rough, but has that ERA down to a team best 3.24. Him and Jose Berríos have carried their share of things. I don't know if that quite gets to an A. I'd have to sit down with it and decide how tough a marker I want to be. Thanks for the text in the text line. We will keep the ones I didn't get to today for later in the week. Promise we'll continue to sprinkle those in. Jays Astros, Yariel Rodriguez against Hunter Brown at 3 o'clock down at Rogers Center. We got Kipper and Bourne coming up for you for 3 hours because it is the open of NHL free agency, and the Jays are going to sign some backup goaltender or something like that everyone will melt down about. We'll be back with you at 10 a.m. tomorrow to break down the first of this game and set up the rest of this Astros series. Thanks so much for listening. Have a tremendous Canada Day, everyone.